inviting me here, and word of mouth, of course, came by Seamus speaking him, you know, she's doing Italy, and that's how I happen to be here, so pleased I am indeed. I'm going to read from my three books, but I'm also going to read some new poems as well. So I'm going to start with a poem called Until I Did. I was brought up in a family of brothers. I was the only girl in the family, and I was also very much younger than the youngest of my brothers. And they just seemed very strange beasts when they were growing up, when I was growing up. And my brother, who had the bedroom next door to my bedroom, I could hear him all the time going in and out of his wardrobe. But he never seemed to come out in any different clothes. So, until I did. I never understood why my brother, at the bottom of his wardrobe, underneath his table tennis weeklies, kept a pile of magazines filled with slouching orange ladies. Of course, I could never ask, but I knew how being curious about the world was meant to be good. I never understood why in the top drawer of their dressing table, under father's laundered handkerchiefs with their embroidered monograms, were these strange shapes, like cut-off fingers from an industrial glove. Out of curiosity, and if he'd stand still long enough, I used to put one on the dog's tail, then watch him wag it off. There were many other things I didn't understand until one day I did. That was a rather ridiculous poem, so something a little more sublime. Visit. Had I known you were there, I would have knocked softly or slipped off my shoes. I watched your wings open and close like hands uncertain of prayer, your plumed antennae write manuscripts around the whitewashed walls, then alter them again as you explore the realm of my laptop, finding it to be part of a table. The table, part of a floor, a room, a whole city, a planet, a single point. Oh, mighty little thing I cannot name, the moon must have spooned you in between the tides of my curtains. The landscape I was brought up in was the landscape of Lincolnshire in the east of England, Midlands, and then east of the sea. And it's very, very flat land, full of fens. And I'm called a yellow belly because I was born there, because they used to be, before the Dutch came and drained off all the fenlands, there used to be a special type of yellow frog that could only be found in that part of Lincolnshire. So a Lincolnshire yellow belly. But I did wonder if when somebody rings me up from a distance and they're a stranger, I can instantly recognise that they're from Lincolnshire. And I'm sure you can do that around different places in an island. You know the sound of that voice belongs to that part of the country. But what I did wonder was, I mean, Lincolnshire accent is very low, flat, drawl, slow. And I did wonder if that was pre-language related to the landscape, where, you know, when people were making sounds and beginning to formulate sort of more like words, was the fact that it was a low, flat landscape, did that influence the way that they spoke? And then I thought, well, if I went up to Scotland with those sort of granite peaks everywhere, are the people in Scotland, do they have a brighter, more varied voice? And the answer is yes, they do. And if I go down to Bristol, where there's some lovely rolling downs there, is the voice of the Somerset, is it a rich, rolling, fruity, soft voice? And yes, it is. So if anybody fancies a subject for a dissertation, I think that's a pretty good one. I don't have time. In fence light, even the fish swim slowly in Lincolnshire. Dykes and drains, crossland so flat, there's never any hurry for anything to get anywhere. No strong tidal pull or rush of rain to flush hillside streams. No wonder the eels are famously thick. They like the dark arms of men working in the pea fields or hoeing acres of red soil. Lurking among tall reeds, the pike grow vast, their grins more enormous than sluice gates. Take any afternoon, as the slow sun rolls a peachy glow across its even wider fields, and pheasants puncture the air. You can hear labourers loading long-handled tools into tractor trailers, and drifting above hedgetops, nothing distinct, but a beautiful drawl, I'm sure, means see you tomorrow, take care, love even. And the coastline where I live now in Yorkshire, just north of Hull, on the east coast there, is the fastest disappearing coastline in the whole of Europe. And it's because cliffs are made of, you know, Jurassic sandstone and slate and boulder clay. And they don't stand a chance when we get the equinoctial tides and, you know, high winds, high tides. It's just gets sort of all the way. And, you know, little houses that are on old maps that used to be in villages next to the sea, no longer on the maps, no longer exist, they've gone. And roads now just sort of peter out at the edge of the cliff. So I wrote this poem called Kleptomaniac. The sea has set its stalls halfway along the beach. We rummage through its bric-a-brac, collect smooth glass, driftwood, unusual rusty shapes. Snatched down from someone's roof, socked cornerless, a marled and sooty stack sunk into the sand. Who would have thought to find this here? Brick red symbol of the heart of home. And close by, a whole corner of the house claimed and prized away as frightened fingers lost their grip. Were they prepared, the family on the sofa by the fire? It was the familiar sound, the hungry sea opening wide its jaws, calling down on the tongue of the wind into the room, tweaking the lights. Generations had heard it so, slept with it, when angry bellowed at each other over the top of it, and laughed. The storms come closer, they said, kept saying. Only the garden shivered and shrank. Imagine that sea, gnashing and grinding and hissing, a great greedy cobble-filled mouth, world's traveller in league with the wind, defining and looting the land. Then that house, a home, raked down on a whim, to end gobs at the clay cliff's back with spittle and trash from the sea. A kleptomaniac is stamping down this coast. I want. Do you have hardware stores here?
Yeah.
Do you have things called B&Q?
You do.
Oh, goodness me. I think hardware stores have always been my favourite sort of shop, followed closely by ship chandlers, which are very similar. And I don't know why it is, but in the relatively small store area, these little individual hardware stores, they manage to get in 300 times more than these great huge B&Q things out on the ring roads. I've never quite worked that math out, but it's true. And what's more, you can buy one of this or two, or you don't have to buy packets that have got five in when you want to sleep. In praise of hardware stores, I love the way they step outside to greet you, waving their long-handled bristle brooms and yellow plastic dustpans, their sack barrows and lightweight extending ladders. They occupy the pavement, edge towards the butcher's next door, as if eager to count his chops or pluck his hung capons. I swear the clothes props and guttering, the companion sets and mops are trying to cross the road. Strung around the doorframe are clusters of gleaming pans, like drops of fruit on a vine. And if they let you through, you're in a grotto of stalactites and stalagmites, towers of stacking bowls and buckets, linoleum rolls, stainless steel, crystal, glass, pyrex, chrome and brass, galvanized iron and teflon. And oh, the sweetness of their breath, a mingle of beeswax and paint, nitromoss and paraffin, creosote and rope. There's rows of tiny cup-handle drawers filled with every type and size of screw and nail, hook and hinge and curtain track end. Oddments you can buy one off or two gross. And camouflaged among it all is the man who knows where everything is kept, because he loves each single item as if it were part of his own bloodline. What more is there to do in life but help solve each other's problems? To put into someone else's hands across the polished countertop something to make their life glide by more smoothly? Or, in one breath, raise the subject to the price of bread? The race to reach beyond the universe. When you're a lady of a certain age, like I am, and you find yourself single, the available gentlemen are the ones who have either never ever been married, have been married 300 times, are still married, or have lived with their mother all their lives and never left home, or like this particular one, a widower. The widower's button. I asked you for thread and needle to repair our sudden heat, but her straw sewing basket, pink raffia flowers and butterfly, contained all your marriage years, the children's woven name tapes, her suture scissors, the repair kit from a hotel in Beijing, odd buttons and presters fastening the four of you together. She must have used this same needle, this same white thread, easing them along cotton hems, newly laundered shirts, the smell of sheets fresh from the line. I was to have sewn your button on, but instead I am threading gaps into a patchwork whose pattern I can only glimpse through photographs and ornaments, the bathroom shelf, what I imagine behind those wardrobe doors. I take up her embroidery, a perfect lawn in variegated strands, feather stitch and satin stitch, lazy daisies along an unfinished path. It's left with the threaded needle in, as if the phone had run, or she'd gone to put the kettle on. You bring me a cup of tea. Watch me flounder with the button. The needle's point refuses to come up through the hole. The cotton twists back on itself, ends up in knots I have to tease out gently, knowing that if I try too hard, I might slip and prick my finger. Snap the thread. You all have neighbours who will do you favours, like feed the cat if you go away, or put out the bin for you, or something like that. Well, I had a neighbour who actually always, forever, used to be asking me to do things for her, and I never got anything done in return. And she had a rather splendid minor bird, She was away rather a long time, this particular time. And I promise you, I don't like to put swear words in my poems. It's not my voice. It's not me. So if you don't want to hear, just I'll put my hand up when they're coming. My neighbour's minor. No, of course I didn't mind. He was marvellous company. No, he was never a shriek of trouble. I didn't even have to use the blanket. But I was surprised when you rang, told me you'd be away another month. No, Harry and I got on together fine, chattering away till bedtime. He's got the most beautiful eyes, hasn't he? No wonder he liked being opposite the mirror, the one above my fireplace, the one I saw your car eventually come back in. Now I'm amazed how quickly he picked things up. The kettle's whistle, spitting logs, the top stair, and oh, that fuck must have come from when I put the phone down on your call. I'm afraid you've ruffled my feathers. People assume that because I'm on my own, I have no life to speak of. Well, you. He seems to like that sound the most, you know. Perhaps you could pretend he's saying, look, he's just black. No, blacker. You'll never guess what else he tried to do. Did he ever have a go at that with you? Something on a much more serious note, a poem called Katya, and I won't tell you which specific war I was writing this poem about, because it actually can apply to almost any war and has been throughout history, sadly, and things have not improved. I mean, what politicians make our people do is just outrageous. This is in the voice of the daughter of a woman called Katya. And it's a case where the men folk have gone off to fight the war, and the enemy soldiers have come in across the border, raped the women, locked them, left them in their houses. I often write about grey areas, and this is one. Like, who can say, you know, whatever a woman chooses to do when she's found herself pregnant from that situation, who can say her choice is wrong? You see what I mean? Who dares to say whatever she chooses is the wrong choice? Katya. I should just say this is the poem that won the Amnesty International Award. Katya. Not of my own choosing, do my patch darken like muscles, my belly slowly swells. I cannot see my valley now. I crave for lassie, but it brings us rusty water in the bottom of a can. They come and come, day, night, day, unbuttoning as the door slaps against the stucco. They leave our thighs and faces crusty with their stink. And after me, they hump across onto my mother, covering her shrunken face with her heavy, dirndled skirt. She is dry, dry. Her womb is a husk. Each day, I am ripening. I do not want this cuckoo fluttering its rapid wings in my darkness. I can see its wild eyes beneath its skin. It will suck me dry as rock. Yet, I have practiced its birth. How I will keep my legs far apart, my eyes screwed shut, then roll it with my heel in the dust, kicking it and its afterbirth down the mountainside. Or, how I will say, give me my baby. And boy, or girl, call it Katya. That was my mother's name.
Yes, this is my love.
I think we need to end the first part on something which isn't quite as dark as that. I belong to your Astronomical Society, and I've quite recently got my first telescope, and I go to the monthly meetings, and we have terrific experts come and tell us about different scientific, mathematical, photographic things, and I've learned about that much, but that's quite a lot in terms of astronomy. Sometimes we have an expert who really is an expert and knows this stuff brilliantly, but is not good at communicating with clarity, and it's at that point when I find myself looking at a lovely picture centering on that PowerPoint, or putting my poet's hat on instead of my astronomer's hat. This is cool. It's the longest title I've ever had for a poem. A reasonable question for a poet to ask the visiting speaker on optics at the Astronomical Society meeting. When I look through my telescope, spiral galaxies and comets, planets, things I cannot see, slide down the tube and through the black hole in my iris enter me. Then my heart beats from the edge of the universe. So loud, stars are set quaking in my bright dark. Even Taurus shies behind my breastbone, thinking he hears a stampede. So why, when I step aside from my tripod and gaze up, are all the stars back in their place, with the exact multitude and brightness as before, while they still inhabit me? Of boy brothers, and it was always very, very painful at Christmas when they came to have such exciting things bought for them. So I looked on with envy when presents were being unwrapped. This is called Boys' Toys. Mm-hmm. Not for my brothers, the blonde wigged plaster doll would tip me back to wink at your eyes, nor for my brothers, the china tea set or jewellery box, whose lifted lip twinkles with music, a frou-frou ballerina pirouetting, unable for every other 180 degrees to admire herself in the mirror. Across the room, and in that same mirror, I would watch my brothers unwrap huge boxes filled with what seemed weightier, more important things. Railway station platforms, teamed with tiny people carrying cases, a shiny signal box, a girder bridge. I loved the dark green flag Scotsman with its red-faced stoker and never-empty tender, the bright blue mallard sporting a swept-back front and swivel bogey wheels. There were other engines too, with different names, different destinations, then miles and miles of silver track to take my brothers to them. They learnt how the hollow curves would bring them home again in time for tea. I had to stay behind, put my kettle on the breast tin stove, set out saucers, cups and plates of rubber cakes, strap that plaster doll down on the track. When I was at primary school, we had an A to Z primer, which would have a big capital A on one page, and then a picture of two things beginning with A with a little word underneath, and then the next page would be B, and so on, throughout the whole book. And for some children, this was a way, not only did they learn the alphabet, but they extended their vocabulary slightly. But, you know, I realised that children can learn quite sophisticated words as well, even from quite a young age, and especially, you know, if they listen to their parents talking about, or relatives talking about the work, the sort of work they do, and what the names of the tools and the processes are that they use, or if indeed a child has been through a trauma. And this particular poem I've written is called The Song the Letters Sing, which is the name, actual name of the primer that I had at school. And it's a long, thin poem, and there's only three words on each line. And two of those words are exactly the words from the primer, the exact words. And one of the words is something that has been picked up from a trauma happening within the family and new vocabulary coming in this way. So there's like a sideways narrative going through it, but there's also a vertical narrative running through the middle.
Wow.
Are you following
that? Yeah.
The song the letters sing. Apple, ambulance, ant, ball, broken bat, cat, crashed cup, dog, driver, dish, eye, examine, egg, frog, fatal, fish, gate, grave, boat, hospital, home, hat, ink, inquest, ivy, jackknife, jelly, jam, kite, curbstone, key, leaf, lawyer, lorry, manslaughter, monkey, mat, nightmare, nest, nut, orange, orphan, octopus, pig, pram, pronounce, queen, questions, quilt, recurrent, red, road, sun, sustain, song, tree, trial, tie, umbrella, utmost, up, violin, violent, van, windmill, wreckage, web, x-ray, fox, xylophone, yacht, yesterday, yellow, zebra, dip, zombie. I have mentioned that my mother's from Cork, so I was brought up in going to church a lot of times household for a few years. And this next poem is called Under Pressure, because I absolutely loathe and detested pressure cookers. They were the microwave of their day, but I also hated gas cooking, the sound of gas, the smell of the gas as it used to be then. And you know that pressure cookers, how they jiggle that little weight on top? It just used to terrify me. And one day, under pressure, for 6 days of the week, you lurk in the awkward cupboard by the cooker, your twin handles interrupting the flow of other pans. Here, you are as solemn and silent as that pause between father's grace and Sunday lunch. But I know you're there, waiting for Sunday night, waiting to put the fear of God in me. You will make windows lacrimose, the kitchen fill with hiss and puff like reluctant confessions. When your pressure builds, the judder of your jiggling weight is louder than an off-key carry-on. You grow larger than the kitchen, smell rank. In an election, you would stand as anti-birdsong, anti the sound of wind rippling through barley, anti the ocean breaking on shingles. You'd be anti all things I love. But I know my mother worships you, adores the way you make cheap cuts tender, a meal in under 7 minutes. She doesn't notice your trick of turning bright colours grey, doesn't mind the sogginess of sprouts, the slimy coats your pale potatoes wear. Then I find you have inner feelings when, instead of keeping them to yourself, you explode, blasting a hole in the ceiling. What a sin! Father rushes in, swearing like he taught me not to. Mother's at her beat, Hail Marying, while, in the twinkle of a moment, I glimpse heaven through that opening. A few years ago, I had to go to hospital for what they call a major operation, and I hadn't been in a hospital since I had my children, and that's not really being in hospital, is it, having babies? So it was if I tell you that when my children were being born, there were no such things as ultrasounds or, telling you how old I know, and they're big silver trumpets pressed down on your belly and listened to by the nurse. But I'd never seen a scan. I didn't know the new vocabulary of hospitals. So when I went in, I was back on an alien planet. You you know, the rhythm of the day, the language, and oh, just everything, the smells. And I got put in the bed next to the ward mouth. When I've read this before at readings, there's usually been a nurse in the audience or somebody who knows it. They always come up to me and say, it's a ward mouth in every ward. So I felt better for that. Ward mouth. The ward mouth knows everybody's business. The ward mouth knows all the nurses' names and all the nurses' boyfriend's names. The ward mouth knows the minute when everything should happen. Breakfast, coffee, lunch, tea break, dinner, night drink. It says so on the form. The mouth knows all the little tricks, like how the windows open and how to change the angle of the bed. The ward mouth knows what all the shifts are called and that they are all 8 hours long except for nights, which are 2 hours, 40 minutes longer. The ward mouth has been on or knows somebody else who has been on or knows somebody else who knows somebody else who has been on every medication in the drug book. She tells the junior houseman what to do and then tells everyone else. She has to tell the junior houseman what to do. She can't understand what the overseas doctors say. She announces this to everyone except the overseas doctors. The ward mouth is in the bed next to mine. She keeps tugging my curtain back so that it stops the seeing one end corner of the ward. The ward mouth can't understand my need for privacy. She thinks I'm aloof, calls me Lady Jane, almost behind my back. The ward mouth has been in here many times before. There is not much left of her except her mouth. And just occasionally, her fearful eyes. I'm keeping a sort of medical hospital theme going. This is a poem I wrote when my father was put into a nursing home and care home in the last years of his life. He died at the wonderful old age of 99. Mm-hmm. So this is probably him at 97. I did a lot of hospital, care home visiting, and I wrote this poem quite quickly. And we're used, aren't we, to reading a poem. We start on the top line and you work your way down the text. And then I realised that, no, I actually need to come up the other way because it's called set. So what I'll do is I'll read it first of all from top to bottom and then I'll just do a sight tour and then you can come up the set, couldn't I? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Step. And more numerous, or steeper, slower, and cleaned twice a day in a nice shade of rose, though carpeted, the stairs to your room, each time I visit. Each time I visit, the stairs to your room, though carpeted in a nice shade of rose and cleaned twice a day, are steeper, slower and more numerous. Greenhouse. I don't always remember going down the path or taking a key from the potting shed to open the glass door, but often I find myself in his wicker chair he kept there by the stove. How still and quiet it is in this climate, until, one by one, his trowel and secateurs move close as if they want to speak with me. Unused as they are to conversation, the raffia and bamboo canes lean in. The zinc fumigator and galvanized steel watering can shuffle towards my feet. Even the curly cucumbers and seedlings, for all their shyness, rest in my lap. They seem to be thinking quiet thoughts of puzzlement. There's no anger or sullenness. no hurling of gravel stones, but a simple acceptance that his visits are now an absence. His gnarled fingers no longer nip buds to make each plant strong. When my own thoughts grow so silent they no longer draw breath, I sometimes hear a lonely chorus. It's then, it seems, birds dip their wings as they fly over the roof fence. He must have forgotten he left open, and I can't yet contemplate closing. Just two more poems. And the first one, I've waited 10 years to write this poem, and I actually only wrote it a couple of weeks ago, so it's still very wet. I'll read you the poem and then I'll give you back the story afterwards. I've called it September the 10th. The sky begins to switch itself on as a sleepy sun dunks into the sea. Lights hang above traffic heading out, trails of white, amber, red, our trip of a lifetime nearing its end. We take the elevators to the top, know we've only a short time left before the tower closes for the night, oblivious to what a short time really is or will be. In 12 hours, we'll be at JFK. I turn my camera sideways to accommodate the skyscrapers and 50-mile all-round panorama. We're the last in the viewing hall. Crisscrossed by flight lines, our faces float isolate in the glass. 400 metres below, lit garbo barges on their 24-hour waste disposal runs past Liberty's flickering beacon, her headdress radiating into dark. I want to photograph them all, freeze this constant movement. In the top of the world shop, I do the tourist thing, buy a plaque, a bas relief, to bring back home. Then, what thousands today must have done, drop a dime into a slot, wait for the mangled coin. Before I've had time to pocket it, a jangling janitor steps from steel doors, points out the time, chuntering how his buddy has just called in sick, asked him to do his early tomorrow. I genuinely believe that I was the last person ever to get photographed from the top of our trade tower, because we were the last ones in on the Monday night. And of course, was it Monday or Tuesday? It was Monday, wasn't it? And you know, if we were on the plane at 8 o'clock, safe off, and had we been an hour later, we'd have had to turn around in the air and come back. So you know, things happened pretty quickly later on that morning. And I've got the photographs, and I took my ASP camera, which gives you the long shots, because I knew I was going to be in either wide panorama land or skyscraper land. So I've got these photographs from that very point on that at that time. But I can't prove it. I've no date stamp on them, I've nothing. I just know that I can't do anything. I've got the mangled coin, you know, that twisted metal, which is sort of quite ironic now, isn't it? Anyway, so yeah, and I knew. I mean, it was so when we were on the flight back, we were diverted to Paris, and none of us knew what was going on. None of us knew why. And you know, usually if you diverted and you have to wait or transfer or whatever, they'll give you a voucher for a sandwich and a glass of water or something. But we were all taken to a rather smart restaurant and waiter served, and we were treated rather splendidly, and none of us knew why. Nobody said anything. None of us knew why. And we flew back into Newcastle in the north of England, and we got a taxi home from there. And as I got into the taxi, the radio was on in the taxi. And I said, oh, I said, you're listening to a play about where we've just come from. And he says, no, that's something that's really happening. So it was quite astonishing. So we went home and sort of television. So we were probably the last to know about it as well, you know, because we were in the air all that time. Anyway, my last poem is called Stone. And it's asking you to enter into an imaginative reality. That's all I want to end with. Stone. What accident, what chance we met, that from a single point this stone has travelled out through fire and ice to find rest here, cradled in my palm. It might have been a whirlpool eye of Venus, dust howling across Mars, a part of the firmament telescopes cannot reach, a comet's tail writing the sky. It stretches in my hands and yawns. A million eyes open. What colours? Lashes fine as frost. I hum a lullaby, and one by one its eyes begin to glow. Has my life been wasted? It dreams. Was my voice too? Thank you.